Welcome to Rights Watch, a program about human rights around the world from Human Rights Watch. I'm Amy Costello. The 2011 Human Rights Watch Film Festival begins in New York next month. This year's festival explores a myriad of human rights issues, from war crimes in Colombia to ethnic tensions in Kenya. The festival explores smaller stories, too, like a theater performance in a Lebanese prison, and there's an inside look at Los Angeles's Skid Row. One theme among some of the films is conflict and responses to terror. The documentary Better This World is about a pair of teens from Midland, Texas, who decide to get involved in the anti-war movement. In the process, they make a decision that will profoundly change their lives as they face multiple domestic terrorism charges. Human Rights Watch Film Festival director Andrea Holly told me that the Texas teens began their journeys from minor league protesters to accused terrorists because they got involved with a plan to disrupt the 2008 Republican National Convention.
They get to know some of the leaders within that movement. And a gentleman named Brandon Darby comes on the scene.
My name is Brandon Darby, and I work with the Common Ground Collective in New Orleans, Louisiana. We're in the Lower Ninth Ward. Been coming to New Orleans often.
Who, within the film even, is quite a charismatic character. And his background within the context of the film, we learn, is that he had been active in New Orleans post-Katrina and had what people would commonly refer to as street creds.
What I saw was awful. The people here were left to die. The military was out of control, and the police were out of control. If I had had an appropriate weapon, I would have attacked my government for what they were doing to people. I honestly would have. You know, I bought an AK-47. I bought it legally. I was that angry. I was really upset. Because, you know, there are residents here that have said, you will not take my home from me over my dead body. And we have made a commitment to be in solidarity with those residents.
One thing that struck me, of course, that he's incredibly handsome. Very kind of a compelling, composed, soft-spoken guy who really attracted the interest of these two young teenagers from Texas. Describe to me, without giving away too much, how the lives of these two teenage boys and Brandon connect.
Brandon Darby comes on the scene, and something clicks among the three of them. In particular, Brandon sort of impacts them in this way where they start to see maybe direct action or, let's just be honest, violence is going to have the impact we are really looking for and what are the risks we're willing to take.
And the actions that they wanted to take were, as you say, at the 2008 Republican National Convention in Minnesota. These two teenagers are very concerned about the unfolding war in Iraq, and they want to take actions to make a statement that they oppose this war specifically.
Right. So rather quickly, a plan crystallizes to create a series of incidents using sort of homemade explosive Molotov cocktails, whatever you want to say. And as a result of that, you do end up with a situation where Bradley and David are arrested.
Right. And the reason they're arrested is because of an FBI informant. And so the FBI is led to these teenagers through the FBI informant. And then in this film, questions are raised about the use and the potential abuse of informants. Specifically, in this case, whether the informant egged on these boys to take violent action. And let's listen to a clip of two officials arguing about the changing nature of informants in the post-911 world.
Before 9/11, your informant was not allowed to do anything but listen and record. Eyes and ears. Today, it's eyes, ears, and the informant's mouth.
If someone would say that the role of an informant for the Joint Terrorism Task Force is merely eyes and ears only, that would not adequately capture all of the activity that the source could be authorized to engage in.
So what we have there is a debate about the role of this informant and informants in general in the post-9/11 world. And questions kind of about the war on terror and who's caught up in the net within the Department of Homeland Security here domestically. Talk to me a little bit about that.
It's an interesting point because internally at Human Rights Watch, within our counterterrorism, terrorism work, this question has come up. And in fact, this case, which is commonly referred to as the Texas 2, the use of this particular informant is actually rather notorious. And specific to this case, I think the question precisely is this. Would those boys have actually committed the acts they were eventually arrested and indicted for had they not been in contact with that informant? That informant in the film not only participated, but comes off as a leader and a real organizer of the actual illegal acts that they were eventually indicted for.
And we have a similar theme in a film that you're showing called If a Tree Falls, which is a story about the Earth Liberation Front and one of its leaders, Daniel McGowan, who was arrested by federal agents for belonging to a group that the FBI has called America's, quote, number one domestic terrorism organization. What is the Earth Liberation Front, and what are its tactics?
The Earth Liberation Front is what I will call an organization that operates with a cell structure, whereby there are groups placed individually in different geographic locales, and they don't know each other's identities for safety reasons, for security reasons, and actually for tactical reasons, because if one group is infiltrated or arrested, then they can't implicate the others.
Yeah, and I just want to talk about their tactics a little bit. And one moment that we see at the beginning of the film that really kind of galvanizes the movement. Activists begin to mobilize in Eugene, Oregon, to save a huge tree downtown that's going to be felled. And a few activists decide to climb the tree to prevent the authorities from cutting it down. The authorities come in a way that is seen as really kind of over the top. And let's listen to a clip of what ensues, as it will become a game changer among some of the activists in this community.
So bang, bang, bang on the door at 8 in the morning. Some kid says, get out there, they're pepper spraying them in the trees. Get your camera, you gotta get there. I mean, they're pepper spraying them right now.
Hang in there, Jim!
They came up in the fire truck bucket and they cut my pants leg up to my groin so they could spray my leg with pepper spray.
Cutting, you know, their pants and pepper spraying them in the ass and pepper spraying them in the balls. And why they were hanging from the limbs 40 feet up. People were on the street looking at this and going, what the fuck do you think you're doing? And so people were radicalized. They started jumping on the fence and going, quit that shit.
They're tear gassing the crowd and pepper spraying the crowd. It was just crazy, frantic scene that day.
And so the argument that you need to work within the system was pretty well dashed by what the cops did on that day in Eugene. And June 1st was really the day that pissed off a lot of people in this town.
That kind of marks a very important moment for this group.
The events of that day becomes a fight fire with fire mentality. Like, if this is how the powers that be, the man, is going to come down on my beliefs and my system, then this is how I'm going to fight back.
Another kind of fundamental question that's raised in this film is, if I commit arson, but no person or thing is harmed in the process, is that okay if it's for the sake of a larger goal? And we have that idea articulated very nicely in this film. Let's just play a clip when the group discovers how effective it can be politically for their case to commit arson.
On July 21st, 1997, Jake Ferguson and three others slipped into the facility in the middle of the night and burned it to the ground. The company was never able to rebuild. And the arson became a model for the group. In one night, they had accomplished what years of letter writing and picketing had never been able to do.
So is so-called economic sabotage, which is what they allege they're doing, is that morally acceptable if no life is taken or harmed in the process?
Well, to address that debate, I do feel compelled to make a distinction between what is legally acceptable and what is morally acceptable. Legally, as Human Rights Watch does base its work on rule of law, it's not acceptable. Destruction of property within the United States is illegal. And in their case, They did commit illegal acts and eventually, you know, are, of course, arrested and indicted for said acts. On a moral level, I think a lot of people probably have a much more ambiguous view of things.
Yeah, and to me, you know, the sign of any great story is that it raises more questions than it answers. And I think this film, If a Tree Falls, is full of so many really kind of profound questions and things to think about. Andrea Holly, director of the 2011 Human Rights Watch Film Festival, which will be in New York June 16th to 30th. Thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you.
The documentaries When a Tree Falls and Better This World will be shown as part of the festival. And that's Rights Watch for this week. Human Rights Watch is an independent organization dedicated to defending and protecting human rights around the world. For more about Human Rights Watch, including audio, video, and multimedia features, please visit hrw.org. And we want to hear your feedback. You can get in touch at podcast@hrw.org. Thanks for listening to Rights Watch. I'm Amy Costello.